Today on CyberWork, digital forensics professional Andre Krahel is our special guest. Andre talks about the work of digital forensics in federal and government locations, the things he learned during a multi-month attempt at decrypting a well-secured Swiss bank file, and why finishing the research beats any degree you could ever have. That's all today on CyberWork. Also, let's talk about CyberWork Applied, a new series from CyberWork. Tune in as expert InfoSec instructors and industry practitioners teach you a new cybersecurity skill and then show you how that skill applies to real-world scenarios. You'll learn how to carry out a variety of cyber attacks, practice using common cybersecurity tools, engage with walkthroughs that explain how major breaches occurred, and more. And believe it or not, it's all free. Go to infosecinstitute.com/learn or check out the link in the description and get started with hands-on training in a fun environment while keeping the cybersecurity skills you have relevant. That's infosecinstitute.com/learn. And now, let's begin the show. Welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, we talk with a different industry thought leader about cybersecurity trends, the way those trends affect the work of InfoSec professionals, and offer tips for breaking in or moving up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. Andre Krahel is a digital forensics and cybersecurity professional. His background includes time with special cyber operations, cyber warfare, and offensive missions, as well as being a court expert witness. His forensic investigation matters have received attention from Forbes, CNN, NBC, BBC, ABC, Reuters, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. So as you can see from this this lengthy list, Andre has a deep background in digital forensics and ethical hacking, which are two topics that you, the listeners, have told us time and again that you love to listen to. Andre is going to tell us about the time he spent as a guest lecturer at the FBI Training Academy, a bit about the current state of digital forensics as a federal and government context, as well as giving us some info about how that realm differs from similar work done in for-profit or private companies. Andre, welcome to CyberWork.
Thank you, Chris, for having me today.
Since you have such an unusual and distinguished career and background, I wanted to start by asking you about your cybersecurity journey. How did you first get interested in security and computers and tech? And what made you specifically want to get into forensics and incident response?
Chris, I really got into it because I had your style of a haircut.
Oh, yeah?
I'm just joking.
Yeah, it comes with the territory, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. Watching you on a video is a little bit different just for the listeners. Mm-hmm. I truly got into it where I was 19 years old and something very similar to your intelligence agency actually offered me a job. Mm-hmm. I was one of the individuals who managed a forum in a Linux forum. Mm-hmm. Was a really big Linux guy at the time. I definitely didn't like anyone else, not going to name, but I wasn't in favor of any other operating system.
Okay.
Very, very religious at the time, very religious, right? Like Unix-based,
right.
Likes the old tricks, likes the lax VMS systems. I really like that type of forum. And I was pretty good at it, like, you know, really doing a lot of stuff with the Unix. And I was helping other people to be good in the Unix. I was also a mathematical physics major. I was very interested in cryptography and a space, like in the mathematical space. At that time, encryption was really run through most of a function. So like even like RSA is a function with a prime numbers and have a Z and rings,
right.
and the numbers that basically are around these prime numbers. And it was really about the math that you had to create. We often call them functors, that you had to break the space basically of the code and inject your own code either through initial vectors or some other means and try to break the algorithms by another function. So I truly enjoy all of that, you know, being in a Linux, being math, doing mathematical physics, doing some crypto. And basically they came and they told me that I would probably make what my parents do make. I grew up in a family of a political dissident. My father was a politically prosecuted individual. So that was very appealing to me. I did not tell my father for 2 years who I worked for because, of course, we hated government as a family that came from a background of persecution, right? It wasn't something that you're going to go and advertise.
That's some uncomfortable dinner table conversation, I imagine.
That conversation would not go very well. And especially working for intelligence forces, they used to interrogate my father. So it wouldn't be. But of course, it was the curtain was, the iron curtain was behind it, right? The people didn't really change as much, I would say, where they really came from. And that's how I got really into it. And I feel very privileged that at a very young age, become a special forces potential agent, right? So it never became a foreign agent for the country. It took around like, 7 year process. Spent 4 years working at the government. The facility I was deposed was the energy. At the time, Europe had the program where they oversaw the nuclear power plant. So at 20 years old, basically, I cover most of the shifts on the weekends and also one day during a week. Plus, I attended all the trainings. So I became like a very invisible kid at a school.
Yeah, so that leads nicely into what I wanted to talk about next, which is some of your major stepping stones. You sounds like you had a lot of really unusual sort of jobs along the way, and it's not necessarily like a linear path from where you are now to where you started. So what were some of the moments where a new job or a project or an educational path or just an aha moment helped you to grow into your next opportunity, your next step in terms of being a digital forensics person in this context?
I early realized that while I want to profile myself in ethical hacking and then looking at the reflection of that hacking, it's almost like in physics, you have electromagnetic and you have something called electromagnetic shadow or a system, what they call the entropy, like a state of unknown. And then you try to figure out like in that algorithm, what would be the state of known and how you can maybe decipher that unknown into something almost like a predict something from that unknown, almost like a prediction of the better, right, in it. And what were mostly stepping stone for me were through the dedication of the depth that I tried to acknowledge in everything that I was learning or working on every project, just to go and continue deeper in that project itself and always master at as much I could the topic or area I was really interested in. And okay. Also,
whatever you were doing, you wanted to be the very best at that thing you were doing at that moment.
Exactly. And gain as much knowledge. I truly believe the knowledge is power.
Yep.
Wealth, or the health is wealth. And that motto always pushed me forward, right? Get as much knowledge about what you're doing. Try to see what the best people that are actually best in this, what they're doing, how they're approaching, how they're solving that issue. And from some of the notable cases, and I guess because you build that mindset of that dedication that you don't give up, you're always trying, you're always trying to do. And you could call it hustle. You can call being persistent. You can call that you have a discipline of finishing, right? There are many different acronyms. If you were a special forces or intelligence committee that you would assign to this. But if you build that persona that what matters to you is the task and you believe the derivation, the success really comes that you're doing this very well, then derivation is recognition in society. Then recognition is getting paid. Then recognition is to be something else. But if you have a belief that gaining the knowledge creates a derivation of that success that you're seeking from recognition in society to monetary gain, is something that I early acknowledge as my own strategy to work on those tasks. Yeah. And I end up working, for example, on Mr. Madoff here in the city.
Okay.
On his personal stuff. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why I was maybe picked was exactly that. I was known individual who had that mental fitness and stamina,
right?
Mental, physical, and knowledge and industry that I would be the one who can go. And if you ask me to go, I was just going to go and do that. Another large case that probably very notable was UBS investigation into privacy laws by mm-hmm. Department of Justice. Right. So I was part of that whole twister that happened between the UBS and Department of Justice. And I was in Zurich for half a year.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And working on breaking the code, the crypto code for Swiss privacy laws. And from two, three firms that came in and said it's non-doable, actually became doable. And we found a way to attack this. And I come up with a way to attack this in the memory of the computers. It was very slow. Okay. I'm going to tell you it was super fast, but it was very slow. It has something called almost like an Enigma rotating hybrid cipher.
Mm-hmm.
But we were able to do that calculation in a memory and then basically attack and break the code. And then as Swiss realized, the Swiss basically banks realized that Americans are not going to give up. They're going to break the code and they're going to get into the bottom of the documents. They give up.
Yeah,
right? They saw the persistence and they realized that that's what it is. But that sometimes takes that level of being engaged and push it forward.
Yeah. Now you those are some really cool highlights. You know, Bernie Madoff and the Swiss bank hack here. And I like what you said, that you know that there was, it's a sort of a methodical thing. Was that specifically something that you realized when you started it, that the only way we were going to do this is it was going to have to be a sort of a slow methodical attack rather than like a quick brute force or something like that?
No, I was there for 2-3 months and everything was failing. Oh, literally. Okay. I'm glad, Chris, I didn't subsidize that depression with any form of compensation outside, what right. people sometimes do. But I was truly in the first 2-3 months in depression. I mean, almost everything that I knew of failed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. So nothing was really working. And right. and then I'm just looking at this and doing all these classical methods and all kinds of classical tasks. Okay. And then one of the forensic strategies occurred to me, like, why don't we just dump the memory of the computer and start like a really poking around memory? I mean, this is a long-term shot, but what if this is going to work? What if that's the way we're going to figure out, and maybe we can read exactly how each buffer is allocated when the encryption happens. And maybe we can create our own algorithm how to decipher. Maybe we can take something out of the memory and then basically decrypt these documents on the fly.
Wow.
And that actually did work. I've seen the same replication of the strategy in WannaCry. Okay. One of the tools from WannaCry actually replicate the same model where if you take a memory of the computer, you actually get the prime numbers and calculations for the encryption key and you can decrypt the data. So I kind of thought that's a cool. 15 years later, the same trick actually does work.
Yeah. Now, was that a completely new technique when you did it? I mean, did you have a sense of like we've cracked this in a completely different way?
Definitely. I haven't seen anyone at that time. Well, I'm sure some other intelligence agencies were doing this type of work, right?
Okay.
But wasn't like really.
Tell you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But wasn't this like something you would advertise? And we didn't advertise either. I didn't write a paper after that. You know, after we did it.
Right.
That this is the way, this is the schema, right? We basically keep it almost like a harsh, it's almost business confidential property at that point of a time that, hey, look, if you have this Enigma rotating ciphers and you can't really attack them because on a static data, it's very hard to decrypt it. There's one way to do that is basically do the memory-based attacks.
How much of this was coming to this technique and this idea was collaborative? Because it sounds like you were sort of bouncing ideas off with other people in your team here. Was this something where, you know, because I want people to sort of know that maybe, you know, maybe you will have that great spark of an idea, but I think a lot of times it comes down to having lots of people sort of thinking at the same problem in at the same time like that. Was this something where it was sort of like you came to the idea collectively?
So I was leading a team of two more individuals that was basically helping with the project. Mm-hmm. And they bounced some idea too. Mm-hmm. I came up with the idea to take the snapshot of the memory.
Okay.
And then one individual came with the idea that, well, it's good if we take a snapshot of memory, but why don't we take multiple snapshots when basically you slide a card, encryption card in that we were provided, and then basically let's see what happens, like a debug also the memory, or and also create a snapshot of that, right? So you often have, I would say the team effort really comes and you said, well, it was my idea to do the memory. That's great. Mm-hmm. But you know what? You also had an idea to create a champagne glass that you told me, Chris, right? But then you still had a factory, you need a good sand, you need to, right?
Yep.
So yes, idea is great. And you can claim ownership of idea. I'm a type of person that I'm not really, yes, the idea is great that you have, but I'm a true believer that a team effort mastered this, right? Mm-hmm. That's why in a special forces of 2-3 people, and when you add them together, one person gets 60%, the other person adds another 20%, another person gets 20%. You master this, I'm a believer, to 100% perfection. Versus that one person, because the pad he already took, maybe get you that 60 to 80%, almost like a part of the type of a rule, right? So, yes, I had an idea, but I also had a lot of horrible ideas that I convinced them to do, right, for first 2 months. And all failed, by the way, okay? And they also had a lot of horrible ideas too, that none of them really work. Yeah. And for 2-3 months, we didn't get anywhere, right, in this in this case. So it's, whenever I try to work on any problem, I always try to find two, three more individuals, like a group of us, right? So it will be group cell, almost like an intelligence cell of 2-3 people with very deep knowledge, but very deep skill set in what they do. So for example, one of them was top-notch programmer and debugger that worked on a team, right? I could do some of it too, but he is doing it at 100% level, right? Yep. And another person was individuals who helped with all the integration APIs with Descriptor, because we basically had to take the documents, find the card readers, get the stuff from the Swiss, and then they told us, well, you can't decrypt it because the keys already expired, this and that, right? So kind of like I replicate as much as possible, come to close to the conclusion, and then I try to put that everything together and see how we can now attack this algorithm. What is the real algorithm? What they're using? How they're rotating the 60 ciphers? How they're rotating these algorithms? Like, what is there some systematic approach they use? Or is truly as random as they're claiming? Is it a basically random to pick? And then go into it.
Yeah, that's a really good lesson to learn here. Is find people and pick people who can sort of cover your blind spots and whose blind spots you can cover as well. So everyone, has a different area of expertise that all sort of come together in sort of a larger than some of its parts.
Yeah. And I would say in a special ops, if you do that, right, you always have, and I know even in civilian world, we say have someone to watch your back. Mm-hmm. You do have to be 360. This is a job of 360, yep. Right? So two people, 180 is not as effective. Three people, 360, effective.
Mm-hmm. Now, so and again, just to sort of bring that back to the beginning, you were saying, I feel like when you were working on this project, you weren't thinking like, oh, this is gonna like catapult me to the next level of my career, and this is not gonna bring me a big paycheck. Like you were so in, while you're busy doing this incredibly difficult thing, like all of the sort of acclaim, as you said, and financial remuneration is sort of happening behind the scenes, but you weren't chasing that. You were chasing the learning and the opportunity. And again, I think that's a really great a lesson for, aspiring professionals.
No, exactly. And I tell everyone, like, when I came in here, I met one of the individuals, former executives of the FBI called Richard Hudak. And I was asking him, like, what is the meaning of being successful? And he basically told me, just do your job the best. Mm-hmm. And people, and yes, you do need to stay recognized. You do need to say what you do, right? Yeah. If you don't open the mouth, don't think that if you don't open the mouth, people are going to know. No, you have to do that, right? Yeah. But you have to have something to back it up, that story that you said.
Right.
And often we get students here for interview and they ask me, what advice would you give me? Mm-hmm. And I tell them, if you had 2-3 papers from a school that you wrote and you published them and they are really in the area that you pursuing, or they are somehow instrumental for that employer, trust me, the employer is going to read them and he's going to be very happy that you conducted some level of research, right, into this topic, and you have some level of understanding. The most challenging interviews are when the person doesn't have much to say.
Right. They sort of took ownership of this one, even if it's a very small problem to be solved, they took complete ownership of it and followed it through.
Yeah. And then it's when we had individuals here at Lifers, we always tell them, people say, well, I want to do this computer forensic. It's really cool what Lifers does. Or I like how you work for, on indictment with Department of Justice, or I like the Secret Service interactions you guys get and all the law. We have someone from agency on our board. I really like that. I said, that's great, right? But this is not about that, right? So how about you start writing a blog about the knowledge that you are capturing right now and try to get into it? And we had a few individuals who, after they start writing the blogs about parsing forensic artifacts, working with forensic artifacts, working, and then they profile themselves, right? They said, well, I'm going to do the Windows forensics. I'm going to do network forensics. I'm doing the iOS and mobile forensics, right? So they kind of like profile the areas on their own research. And then they really can go and be more successful. Or some of them realize, they said, listen, I never realized how scientific this is, this forensic science. I don't think that's a job for me. I'm getting back to development, I'm getting back to audit, or I'm getting back to compliance, which is great.
Yeah.
It's just that recognition of...
It's good to know.
Yeah, it's good to know. And I tell everyone that writing and researching and being instrumental, if one of the jobs you can get is just be the blog writer for a company that does it, actually gives you an idea what these people really do.
Yeah. No, that's... and again, we hit on that so many times here, that the communication is so key. Writing skills are so key, because it's not just enough to, break the case. You have to explain it and explain it to people who don't necessarily live this stuff 24 hours a day. Yeah. So as we noted in your bio.
Exactly. And then also
Go ahead.
Yeah. And also if you, Chris, working on any of these cases with the attorneys, right? There is a report that's coming out of that. There's a very, everyone says, well, where is the forensic report? And that's a document. It's legally binding and discoverable. So writing skill set is very important.
Yeah. So as we noted in your bio, you were a guest lecturer at the FBI Training Academy. And so we've had guests talk about digital forensics in financial areas and law areas. And we had Amber Schroeder of Parabin talk about some major forensics products that they make. But I don't think we've really had that much experience with digital forensics on a government or federal scale or in that area. Can you sort of tell me about how digital forensics, if there's any difference in the way that you work with government agencies, if it changes the nature of how you work, if there's additional sort of like security issues or clearance issues or confidentiality issues or anything that make it a different type of work?
Yeah, sure. If you will directly work at a government, you do need to have a clearance. So that's normal. If you work in a commercial sector and you're working for the victims and government is parallel to it because it's criminal, then you might not need a security clearance, meaning that if all what you're doing is collecting the evidence and securing the evidence, you might get involved with something what we call the authentication of the evidence. That's the federal rules of evidence. And then you might be actually called at a court to testify to basically present how you actually conducted that securing of the evidence. This is no different than you and I tomorrow go and collect the fingerprints. And then the FBI needs to get that fingerprints, but you know it's been 1 month later, so they have to rely on fingerprints, and you have to authenticate your method that you use for that case. Now, the federal government always have to open their own investigation because it's criminal. Like none of us is in criminal investigation business. Government is, right? So the government. The good news is that the government will open its own investigation. Can they leverage anything from your investigation? The answer is yes. Right, so they will learn what you have and where you are at the moment. So I feel very privileged that a lot of our work at the LifeRoads led and that cooperation with the Department of Justice indictments. So, for example, individuals from Lazarus on cryptocurrency hacking. We were one of the firms in your Google NiceHash story and how they got hacked for $60 million. Another one, CoinCheck, for close to $500 million. And if you Google the stories, how we were involved in, for example, very heavy NiceHash investigation. It's a very impressive investigation on a nation state level and working on these nation state threat actors. Two Iranians, if you recall, the SAMSAM group that breached the hospitals. We work with the Newark division here of FBI. That was a really great case. We work on cases for Exedic. That's another example. A few of the APT group out of the very large country in Asia that everyone knows of, not as important, but the groups are very important. Right. And by the way, the group around 10 years ago launched one of the most massive supply chain attacks in history. Right, so these supply chain attacks have been ran by this military group for less than 15 years. That's exactly how the cyber warfare is being played. Right, so it's not as direct. It's usually very indirect, and the supply chain was always heavy focus of nation state. That's how it actually was conducted. But at FBI Training Academy, I feel very privileged that I was one of the selected people to speak, and the program has like 12 to 15 sessions. Program got partially canceled because of the COVID and when the COVID came in.
Sure.
And I had most of the executives and state police and head of the various FBI states and head of the various state police and various officials from various states, and basically it rotates. So you can, right? For security reasons, you don't put them into one location because, right? And these locations are usually classified where you go to. And then talk about the primary threat actors that we actually have seen on some of our investigations. Major focus of the federal law enforcement in the U.S. is something called business email compromise and extortion, cyber extortion. And of course, then you have a nation state, the separate category. But from those criminal, very large is something called business email compromise, meaning someone gets into the email system and conducts usually fraudulent wire transfers out of the company. And ransomware, when they get in, they usually exfiltrate the data and they encrypt the system, right? So there's like this double dipping momentum in it. And then really speak about the cases and experiences of people who we've done, like, for example, like a riot that's been attacked, various hospitals, right in election time. And it basically explains these threat actors, like how, what are there is what we call the techniques, tactics, and procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And also what is the something called indicator of compromise, like how you really think through it.
Right. Where did it come from?
And it's more on these lessons learned. You try to explain is the process to handling this ransomware, this cyber pandemic. And I would say the cyber is one of the industries that trying to get hold of is very well, because every strain of that virus is very different, right? Yeah. So there's no universal cure here, meaning that you don't have one thing on one product can cure all. Yes, right. The vendors tell you there's one product that does everything,
this is
right?
Gonna take
on
care
endpoint
of all your
and everything, exactly. But any environment you come in, they usually have a 40 products. Average company, like a Fortune 2000 is getting like right now hacked, has 40 different products, and all of them have 100% proof basically to do something that's purely magical, right? That's pure magic outside of it. So it's more of like a demystify that, look, it's reality is we all going to get something from a cyber call to cyber cancer. And there is no person on the planet that haven't seen doctor, you know, in whole life. We probably going to see the doctor. And it's just the question is that if you focus, let's say, 50% of your strategy on detection and prevention, you should also plan the defense mission. And that's the, how you're going to respond when something happens. Yeah. And the companies who are very successful, or our government also that are very successful, is that they really play in the context of if something happens, if that phishing comes in, yes, it gets through it. The user is on it, but we were able to remove the links the user didn't click, or user clicked, but we have this product that detects it. Now we act, we isolate the computer and we isolate the problem. And then we stop this pandemic from spreading because we had this early detection warning that yes, we have this infected system on a network. When that doesn't exist, then exactly you have a global pandemic, right? The companies are a global pandemic, everything's a global pandemic. And the threat actor basically laterally moves from a system and affecting the computers and basically the exfiltrating data. So the federal enforcement always seeking more of a wisdom of what really happened at the public sector,
right?
What really happened in the private sector? And in the private sector, are they doing something maybe a little bit different, or are they learning lessons, right? The government has a much higher budget, of course, than the private sector, but are they really maybe thinking about these issues? Like how they really, what's a strategy? What is their strategy to be in a business, stay competitive, deal with a business in a compromise, deal with a ransomware? And what are the real stories that someone who is doing this type of forensic investigation actually seen, and how we are really advising these clients going forward? That's the one piece. Second piece is also demystify this conversation with the federal law enforcement, right? Like something happens to you, or FBI is going to send two cars, you know, eight agents going to appear in the office. And the answer is no. Government is busy too. Government actually heavily relies on firms like us to do that collection. The government heavily relies on a firm to provide them the evidence.
Yes.
And the government actually doesn't care as long as the firms know what they're doing, that the evidence is being provided to the government. And then they can run their own investigation. And they can come in and do this their own work.
That's what I was going to ask next, was how much sort of autonomy do you have in terms of the decisions you're making in the forensics that you're doing? I mean, are they basically giving you a set of directives? Find this, enter this, you know, find the indicator of compromise here, or are you sort of given the freedom of like, we know something's happened here, sort of find it in whatever way you see fit?
It's a very collaborative effort, meaning that when we have something, we share it, but often when we stumble on a case, and let's say we have a conversation with the FBI or with the Secret Service, often they have more than we do, meaning that they have something under TOP protocol, TMP Amber, something they're already investigating. Like let's say there is a FBI Denver division investigating this case for the last 2 years. They have a lot of material, like a techniques, tactics, procedures, IOCs, and things they can share. So usually what we try to do when we get a commercial case that agrees to cooperate with the federal law enforcement, basically get very close to the unit that is investigating this threat actor, this specific threat actor. And then the federal law enforcement, you know, the FBI is really helpful to help that victim to get up and running with the knowledge they have. Of course, the knowledge has to stay concealed with the help of that victim only, right? So it doesn't go outside. They're still working on their case. They still want to close their criminal case. So they don't want that knowledge they get share or the ideas they share really to go outside of that circle. But they want to help these victims. right? So it's for the benefit of the victim. And then in, often we play this conduit where we translate. Often we have something and give it to them and say, well, if we haven't seen this yet, right? So we're going to add that into it. Then we don't know who they're sharing with, right? But the same way they're sharing with the other victims and they say, well, go and scan this. And someone asked me, why is that important? I said, look, it's like each virus, for lack of better understanding, has some scanning and detection process. And we created this indicator of compromise. Whole idea is that I'll give you that set. If you scan in your endpoint, you scan your network logs, you scan your SIM, you scan your threat intelligence, then you actually will realize, wow, I had this cyber cancer here half a year ago.
Right.
It's gone. Mm-hmm. Or no, it's not gone. It's still here.
Still here, yeah.
Right. That's the aha moment, right? Like, hey, what are we going to do now? Like, it's been here for half a year. Like, should we jump out of the window, right? No, no, that's different.
Right, right.
Should we plug all the cables out?
Set it on fire. Yeah, right.
Right. So how do you react when you realize that, well, I have a nation state for half a year on my network?
Wow. Yeah. 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 So I want to sort of pivot over from, I mean, do you have any particularly interesting, you told me about Bernie Madoff and you told me about the Swiss bank. Do you have any particularly interesting like war stories that you can share with us in terms of like an especially tricky case or you know, a strange solution that you found?
Yeah, there was a one at the end of 2019.
Okay.
And there was a group that was deploying a ransomware called DoublePamer or BitPamer. Mm-hmm. And they were able to circumvent most of the EDR products. And we, when we realized that that's exactly what's happening, we decided to actually develop something called cyber vaccine. It was before the pandemic even hit. We had this idea that we're going to develop this cyber vaccine. And it's, the way it's going to work is every time you have this new strain, we actually do going to have someone from, we have 4 or 5 PhDs on our staff. So we're going to have these PhDs to actually create something that can be attached to the endpoint product to basically do the removal, like a containment eradication and recovery for that endpoint. And we wrote a really good paper about this, and we got a lot of good traction, and it was used for many victims. What was also interesting about later on in performing this investigation, there's some penetration testing called Cobalt Strike. And Cobalt Strike is a product that helps you to create this memory type of resident beacons. So basically very limited footprint on a disk, but primarily lives in a memory. Chris, this is something like a virus living only of your DNA. You take it out of the DNA, it dies, right? So very hard to detect, very hard to do. By the way, if tomorrow, if you go to a doctor and tell him you have a DNA virus, you might end up at some mental institutions for half a year, just to check your sanity,
right?
Because no one's going to believe you, right? It's it's like almost like a, hey, you know, a military from foreign nation is in my network. Yeah, mm-hmm. sure, right?
Sure.
On your phone too, right? So it's not as this really plausible story, but that they actually do happen. So Cobalt Strike actually mimic this high level of engagement just purely in the memory of the victim's computers. And in virtue of when we're looking at it, we realize that we stumble on something on a threat actor called APT41, where they almost seems like compromised the ransomware people, took their things, took the whole kit, and pretended they're deploying it while they were stealing the data and blaming them.
Hmm. Wow.
So that was kind of like an interesting angle. So we're going from this bit payment, double payment, cyber vaccine to looking at this ransomware. And now we're looking at this one really, really large nonprofit organization. Something is not lining up. And we're looking deeper and we find these, you know, almost like a digital shadows all around. And it seems to be, hold a second, this looks a little bit different. And then we found out that it was a nation state threat actor who probably compromised the bad guys, the criminals,
really?
Took their kit and deployed it and blamed them while they actually were doing something else on the network. So that happens too.
So someone was attacked and then the attackers were attacked by an attacker. Is that what I'm hearing?
That is correct.
Wow. Okay. That's incredible. Yeah. And you said you found that just by kind of looking at sort of like artifacts and shadows of things that were happening, and you sort of deduced that based on sort of anomalous events and things.
So it was more of a call from that company. They already had, you know, a lot of these forensics now come from these insurance carriers and law firms working with insurance carriers. So this was already closed by an insurance carrier, the whole investigation. Right. So they had a firm. It's almost like you come to and says, well, I want to fix this bumper, right? And they're going to fix your bumper, but they don't really look at it. They don't think you have a damage on engine, right? Or a damage on engine would require like a really much more sophisticated operation. And they ran some basic check. They don't see anything and they move on, right? So this is one of those investigations that is already closed. The claim is closed. Everything's closed. But you have these two, three individuals that don't believe the story. Mm-hmm. It's just something is not lining up here.
I see.
And then they call for independent review of the investigation. It's already closed, by the way, right? It's already closed, mm-hmm. already sealed, right? And they're saying, well, look, if something is not lining up, can you just look at this? Let me tell you, I think that this system. So then on one of the systems, we did find the traces. Then we approached the firms that did the work and also the insurance carrier. And of course, they right away said, no, we don't want, you know, we don't want to cooperate. We don't want to help you with this.
Yeah, we don't want to open this up again.
Yeah, exactly. For us, it's a sealed case.
Yep.
And then we basically worked with the victim and turned to be actual nation state. And they were happy, really, that they, you know, found the truth behind it, because it just was not, the story was not lining up what it presented.
Now, I mean, that's an awesome story, and I thank you for telling me about that. But I want to pivot over to back into the sort of work aspect of cyber work here. You mentioned at the beginning, and I think it's really good advice that, you know, if you're a new person entering the digital forensics realm, that the employers are going to look at your research papers. They're going to see that you've taken ownership of a certain problem and you've solved it to the greatest of your abilities. But beyond that, can you sort of talk about particular skill sets or experiences that people should be striving for if they want to do digital forensics, especially in a government or a federal sphere? You know, apart from like just being dogged and being obsessed, like what should people be looking to sort of get into to make themselves appealing to employers?
So at an early stage of my career, I was one of the individuals, and probably the horrible mistake that many of us do make, that I believe in this superior technical abilities are the only way to go.
Okay.
Right. So superior knowledge into it. Later on in life, I realized that one of the reasons I was picked is that never occurred to me is that I'm one of the individuals that if you put me in a lot of pressure, I'm not going to break and I'm not going to cry. Unless you, Chris, is going to play some really bad rap music, I don't cry. Right? Right. But if you do that, that's it. Right? So, but everyone has this breaking, I'm trying to tell you, everyone has this small breaking point
that
you can find. We all do. Just the question is, how big is this breaking point that you have? And what is really will create this scratch on your shoulder that you don't like about it? And it's very important even to balance mental, physical, and intellectual capabilities of the individual. You can have someone who's very strong technical, he's very strong in anything, but it's very hard to work with him. Mm-hmm. Very hard to work with on a project, very hard to explain, can perhaps run, if you ask him to work 10 hours because you have to finish something, he can, because after 8 hours, he gets into very unstable emotional state, or intellectually, if you challenge him and you ask him to speed up, he starts making mistakes, right? So those are the qualities that if that work requires, then the person needs to have. In the forensic science work, I guess you might have a two type of employment. One employment is that you're working for a consulting company and the work is coming in and out and you are not bugged by this momentum that you're constantly working on different cases and the speed is very high, right? So you're becoming this, it would be like really flattering, like a Formula One driver every day, and you try not to crash and you try to win the race, right? But you're trying to do that so many times in a month, right? And you enjoy that. You enjoy that ride. Yet the same way you keep your mental and intellectual and physical balance at a shape. So for example, I go running every morning, just 25 minutes, 30 minutes for 3 miles run. And this is my meditation moment. With myself and find myself and really stay energized for a day and stay healthy. And I think that's very important. And everyone who wants to get into really in this career should think about that. It's not only about really being really good, but being a good team player, have good intellectual skill set, how you approach individuals, being very mentally balanced in a society. So basically you are not one of these awkward individuals that just walking around and doesn't want to talk to anyone and, you know, can't present himself. And then also build this mental stiffness. Mm-hmm. Right? Really build this mental stiffness that if you need to put up with some serious load, right, it's not something you understand that that's a part of a job. Right. It's almost like, imagine you go to hospital and the orthopedic surgeon in a middle of the heart surgery says, well, I have enough. I'm going home.
Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. I can't take this anymore. I'm looking at all these hurts.
Yeah. 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 Like I'm in the middle of the surgery. Right. So it doesn't happen. Right. So yeah. Those individuals pick those jobs. Yes. And then you can envy what they have and you can envy what they get paid. The question is, would you want to have their job when their pager goes on and yeah. you have to go there? Would you have a job and work 12-hour surgery on someone? Right, with the people, right. And in the fact that you know that if you make one mistake, the person can die. The good news is in forensics, it doesn't happen at that aggressive level. But what we see, for example, from ransomware, like if you make an error in, let's say, in forensic investigation, things can go horribly wrong.
Right. Yeah.
There is a good case right now of the large data center company being compromised. Mm-hmm. There was a forensic firm who was pivoted in, very large forensic firm, who a little bit underestimated a threat actor. So for a month when they were doing the containment and eradication and isolation of the host, this threat actor went from 10% compromised company at a data center close to 80% behind their back. And I told everyone that doesn't look very good when you're forensic from hired to basically that it happens to. And lesson learned here is, you know, don't underestimate the threat actors, right? Like, yes, you have to create a balance for yourself. But if they're working 24/7, you have to be 24/7 opponent. If they are snipers, you have to be a sniper.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I want to sort of drill into that a little bit because I use a metaphor of saying, like, you know, a lot of people think they want to be, you know, a baker, but all they think of when they think of a baker is, you know, selling a loaf of bread to a nice person at, you know, 10 in the morning. They don't think about being up at 3 in the morning with the ovens, or if they want to be a film director, they just want to, you know, say action and not necessarily be up, you know, in the middle of the night choosing color swatches. But so can you give me some examples of, like, because you said, like, people can get burned out or as they hit a threshold in the day. What are some things about digital forensics that people who might be interested in getting into it aren't thinking about in terms of, this is a real slog, this is more difficult than you think? Like, what are some of the activities that you've seen that sort of break people down who maybe aren't ready to do the hard work of it?
So when the whole COVID started, I really liked the area of the New Hampshire. So I went for 2 months to New Hampshire. And mm-hmm. then in the middle of that, I got called back to New York. And we were asked to look at one of the prominent research and hospital in the city for intervention of the foreign nations into the research. And I'm coming back to New York City. I'm thinking that I'm going to visit all these COVID research facilities.
Right.
Right. And I'm going to be doing these night missions. Right. I have no vaccine. There's no vaccine. There's nothing.
Yes.
And the team, I have to convince the team now to go with me. Mm-hmm. And bust these computers overnight, every night and weekends, right? For, let's say, for a 2 month period. And how I'm going to do that to explain to people that this is a good thing to do.
Right.
To walk in, to you isolate at home and you're happy. And now I'm asking you, no, this is a hospital, it has 3,000 people.
Yep.
We are walking through it.
Yeah. On a regular basis, yeah.
Yeah, at a night, right? It doesn't matter, but, you know, at the night. And then now you're not going to sleep the night, and mm-hmm. this is what I want you to do, and this is what you want to do the weekend, too.
Right, right.
Right? No one can know what you're really doing there either.
Yep. Yeah, you have to be there quietly. Now, speaking of COVID and traveling, if for some of our listeners might be far from large tech centers or large cities and they want to maybe do this kind of work, or maybe they're, you know, coming into it from a different industry altogether. Like, what are some ways that you can sort of get the experience you need in a place where digital forensics is not happening? Is it the sort of thing where you can do it anywhere, or do you really need to be sort of getting your apprenticeship in cities with sort of large consulting firms?
I do think that most of the work, because of the cloud and the way the cloud system is being mm-hmm. hosted right now truly can be done in a fashion acquisition and evidence collection remotely. And then you do need to have a forensic lab. So you and I on a camera, so what you see behind me is actually a forensic lab. It's a full-fledged okay. forensic lab. So you do mm-hmm. need to have a forensic facility. So you have to build your lab, laboratory. Yep. And of course, you have something what we call the road kit, but you have your laboratory. So the same way people sending, like, let's say, tissue blood samples to a laboratory, you have yep. a forensic laboratory where the stuff is actually being sent into. So the good news is that most of the work's always been done in a forensic laboratories, not as much outside of these laboratories.
Okay.
The securing of evidence, meaning go to almost like a crime scene and securing the evidence yep. was something that we were conducting. But now if that evidence is in the cloud, there is no more of that physical presence right. for anyone to go to. There is a process that us and let's say the provider, Google, Amazon, Microsoft actually agrees on, and they provide us this concealed image the best way forensically as it could be, right? So mm-hmm. for example, Microsoft probably has a most advanced process. They have something called Security and Compliance Center, and they have full e-discovery so they can actually go and conduct e-discovery directly and inside of the Office 365 platform. And they do have probably the most forensic type of capabilities, meaning that you can acquire the evidence with a tool and then bring it to the forensic lab. You can just basically download. So for most of the individuals, I would say good news is that you can do a lot of it remotely. You don't have to be where you are. Also, in our division called Managed Services, we basically do what they call the level 3 managed detection response on endpoint, meaning that you can be anywhere. You have access to the cloud console. You're reviewing these alerts. And based on metadata of these alerts, the console lets you interact directly with the endpoint that you're trying to investigate. So now you're not at the customer side. You're not flying to customer side. You are actually very rapid response. And then we, if needed, we call the customer and says, yeah, we want you to unplug the computer from the network. We want you to take a memory image. We want you yep. to take the full forensic image. Yep. We give them a tool. So we tell them go to buy the hard drive. We give them a manual and we walk them through it, how to acquire. If they are not capable of doing that, we only, let's say, dump the memory. Mm-hmm. And they'll tell them, pull the hard drive out, give us the encryption keys and ship hard drive to this laboratory. So,
okay. So with the world being as strange as it is right now due to the pandemic, and we also have this sort of skills gap in many cybersecurity fields, you know, but also job hunting is a little oversaturated. So you have all these sort of balancing, contrasting forces. Do you have any tips for job hunters in the digital forensics field, which might have a lot of openings, a lot of opportunities, but also lots of people applying and it still feels like you're having a hard time sort of finding your niche. Like what do you recommend in terms of making yourself stand out as a candidate from other candidates? I think probably going back to what you said about sort of your ability to complete research and so forth would be a good start, right? Mm.
So I would say we getting less and less traction as a forensic industry, being the digital forensic examiner or being the digital forensic investigator is not as popular.
Okay.
Seems that most of the security is really shifting towards cloud and integration and also mm-hmm. mobile devices. And it is also that feeling of how much work you have to put in versus what the output is. And it's great for all us that cloud is happening, but the same way cloud companies or cloud security or mobile companies can attract the talent, and they multiply on the products, on the revenues, and they offer better share units and phantom stack and options that can lead to very large payouts if the company is acquired. And we see that as a serious competition to basically more of a work being just a forensic examiner. Because being a forensic examiner means that, yes, you might stumble on something interesting. And we, for example, have our own product like a cyber vaccine. And we also create like an extension to the EDR, XDR product just for forensic investigation. Yes, there are some products. They're usually attached to other products, but they're not, not the mainstream, right? That there is a mainstream that you attach into it, almost like you have a car and you just attach the wheels into it, right? So those wheels can come from different manufacturer. And that's not as lucrative for many candidates because the amount of science and knowledge they need to do in order to do the type of job is maybe more significant. Second piece, I would say that maybe more concerning for candidates is the fact that at some point they need to testify at a court.
Yeah.
And do they really want to go and testify at a court? Or do they want to really deal with attorneys? Do they really want to deal with the legal system? Do they really need the study federal rules for civil and criminal procedures and understand like what really the construct is when they working with the evidence? And that's a little bit more work. So I would say that candidates who are seeking jobs right now in forensics are candidates who really like more of a scientific approach into solving something versus more of an automated software, cybersecurity software type of a approach where, you know, I'm part of a cool tech startup that's doing XYZ. And they also seeking the drill from, I like this, you know, Tom Cruise court drama being right. At a courtroom. And I really would like that. You know, I would want to see myself working for a DA office and I'm going to do this forensic investigation and I'm going to be part of a courtroom and I'm going to do this criminal cases. And
this is bad guys.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to bad guys and serve the justice. Like for us as a company, one of our logos always been that we have a something called discipline of finishing. Mm-hmm. Meaning that we never actually ask the victim to pay for us to work with federal law enforcement. We finish actually on our own dime some of the investigations. Meaning we just get the signature from the victim and we work with the federal law enforcement just so the justice could be served. And some of the cases took between 2 to 5 years to be served. So some of it is also you can't expect just getting paid because it's not, you're not doing this because you're looking to get paid. And yes, those relationships with the federal law enforcement do matter. You value them mm-hmm. highly. Mm-hmm. And it is very prestigious to point to, let's say, Department of Justice indictment says, our evidence contributed to this indictment. You know, no one is questioning that. Absolutely. But if there is no outside of that acknowledgement from society or outside of an acknowledgement from the industry, there is no really expectations of something monetary versus in some other cybersecurity fields and that there is that aspect that you probably would get something out of the system. So that would be something for candidates to consider that it is definitely, in my opinion, much more work than just get any other cybersecurity job.
Okay. So you got to really want to do the work if you're going to do the work.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So this has been great. We're coming up on an hour here and I don't want to take much more of your time, but as we wrap up today, can you tell me about your work with Leafars LLC, which as it says, encompasses cybersecurity services, including incident response, digital forensics, ransomware mitigation, and cyber resiliency services. So what are some products or projects that you're excited about for your company in 2021?
Mm-hmm. So I'm really pleased we created with we have office here in US, Europe, and India, and we were able to pull some serious R&D, especially in Europe. And we have a few great individuals like Vladislav Bacho, like some of the top researchers right now. A few like Michael Jurian with the PhD people, right? That they create like automation and in the managed detection response. And cyber vaccine is a product that we almost ready to launch. And mm-hmm. it's basically focusing on any ransomware, detecting ransomware through the techniques, tactics, and procedures. So it's more behavioral type of approach versus, hey, I know this malware, I know the string, and it's going to work because most of the malware you don't know. So we look at behavior, how the ransomware actually operates, and then we deploy this product at the endpoint that would basically detect it and kill the ransomware product itself. So that's what is very exciting. We also have a tool called Gargamel that does the collection. So we are very, very pleased with that. We have another tool called Log Checker that we basically look and enrich the data in logs. We have another tool called Virus Checker that we actually go and check the systems for viruses through the API. We kind of integrate almost something like a virus total, but on the endpoint. And we bring that plugin in that we also developed over the last year. And we developing the Mongoose, which is the extension to forensic to the EDR, XDR products, where it's more on the forensic side, right? So leveraging what the EDR, XDR tools are really doing, and then basically helping us to extract the data. Our company is based basically on the R&D and a product division. And then we do digital forensic incident response. We have advisory practice. We have a managed defense practice, and we have offensive services, or sometimes called technical services. So offensive services like red teaming, penetration testing. And main reason why we have that is basically life cycle half. Imagine when someone has this cyber injury. So when they're taken to the cyber hospital, they are in a cyber emergency room. That's the DFIR unit, right?
Right.
Then we move them into the hospital. And in the hospitals that we have this managed defense, we put them all these monitors from the, flip them from the emergency room to different type of monitors. Then we conduct a lot of the testing, the offensive testing, you know, comes in. And then, you know, when it's rehab, we do a lot of advisory, you know, in this rehab type of, you know, post-trauma, cyber trauma type of environment, right? So we basically mimic this cyber health recovery for some of these other victims, right? In a way where we take them into emergency room, we move them to the hospitals, and we move them into the rehab, and then, you know, they still need some advisory practice. They become the, you know, the family cyber type of individuals for them going forward. And that's been our business model. So most of the companies or enterprise that we work with truly came through that being cyber victim or not, don't want to become a cyber victim mindset. And then we replicated that life cycle. Many of them want us to train them or give them education to listen. And I'm one of the individuals where I always said that one reason I truly believe I am where I am, because I always like to listen to older and wiser people.
Right.
Right. And I never been one of the individuals, or I don't consider myself one of the individuals who makes very strong opinions without any context of a data analytics or any rational and wisdom. Right. Or not even understanding the subject. I always try to understand what that actually is. And I remember when I often work with investors, they told me that a lack of a knowledge never precluded them from many strong opinions.
Right.
But that's the risky investment mindset. And it's not very applicable in digital forensics that we are actually carving as an industry.
All right. So one last crucial question. If our listeners want to know more about you, Andre Krehel, or Lufars, where can they go online?
Feel free to follow us on LinkedIn. Please go to our webpage. It has many white papers and stories that we've done. We also have a GitHub repository that you can go into and see some of the products that we created. And for example, Cyber Vaccine, the first one in 2019 that we did, it's published. And also, feel free to contact us, look at some PR press releases. We have an HR portal where you can send your CV if you're interested to become a writer, or you're seeking something, or you have something that you would like to discuss with us. But I would say generally we are quite a bit all around the social media and channels.
Okay. And it's so, LIFARS.com?
That is correct.
Okay.
LIFARS.com, lifers.com.
Very good. All right. Well, Andre, thank you very much for joining me today and providing your time and insights. I really appreciate it.
Chris, thank you for having me. And as one of the journalists pointed out at the special operations, the culture basically eats the strategy for the breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
So one suggestion to everyone is that create a culture of yourself as a strong professional and create a culture around yourself that the other will perceive that is beneficial to the society. And that's always been motto for us, that we do have a strategy as a company, but our culture is the strategy for the breakfast.
Culture is the strategy. We're gonna leave you with that. So thank you very much again, Andre. And as always, thank you to everyone at home who is listening and watching. New episodes of the CyberWork podcast are available every Monday at 1 p.m. Central, both on video at our YouTube page, on our website, infosecinstitute.com/podcast, or on audio wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. And don't forget to check out our hands-on training series, CyberWork Applied. Tune in as expert InfoSec instructors teach you a new cybersecurity skill and show you how that skill applies to real-world situations. Go to infosecinstitute.com/learn to stay up to date on all things CyberWork. Thank you once again to Andre Krehel, and thank you all again for listening and watching. We will speak to you next week. How about some free cybersecurity training resources for you and your team? Just go to infosecinstitute.com/free to get ebooks, training guides, and more than 100 cybersecurity training courses, all free for CyberWork listeners. Go to infosecinstitute.com/free and start learning crucial new skills today.